Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Virginia. Events over recent years have highlighted racial inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. Here at Broad Talk, we recognise that the path towards true reconciliation is the responsibility of all of us, all the time. In that spirit, we acknowledge the traditional owners of the country on which we record this podcast, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. And a word of warning, the episode you're about to hear includes discussion about some topics that some listeners may find distressing. If you or anyone you know needs help or support, please contact the 1800 Respect Helpline or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
The system is broken.
I don't get the rules at all.
How far can we work within a system that we need to get rid of?
I think men feel somehow women's liberation is a threat to their manhood. And it is.
Tragically, I couldn't give a shit whether you think I have a right to speak up about anything or not.
People who make revolutions get burnt.
We started it here!
Maybe, you know, I've got some sort of crazy speak up about it mental illness.
Change takes time. Do you have any regrets?
No.
Hello and welcome again to Broad Talk. It's wonderful to have you join us. Hopefully I can say yet again, and welcome to the Changemaker series. I'm Virginia Harsiger, and it really is so lovely to have your company. This is a special series that we're bringing you in partnership with MOAD, the Museum of Australian Democracy, housed in Canberra's old Parliament House, where I've had the wonderful honour of guest curating a new exhibition on Australian women changemakers. Now, if you've been listening to this each week, and I certainly hope you have, you'll know that what we do is dive into the personal stories of some of those outstanding women. We sort of poke around a little bit about what it means to be a changemaker, how they got to where they did. We talk about the challenges and we talk about the costs. And as you'll know, it's produces some very real and raw at times, but some very inspiring stories. So if you want to reach out and chat to me about it, please do. You can email me at virginia@broadtalk.net. You can find us on Insta at Broad Talkers, Facebook, Broad Talk, or me, Virginia Harsiger, or Twitter, Virginia_House. Today, it is such a pleasure to welcome Rosie Batty, who I've been wanting to speak with on Broad Talk for quite some time. Rosie is the woman who became a household name in Australia when she was named 2015 Australian of the Year. And at that time, I was actually standing on the parliamentary lawns right in front of the stage on the day that she was made Australian of the Year. And I recall feeling a little anxious for her as she walked towards the microphone to make her acceptance speech. Now, I've thought a lot about why was I anxious. I think because until that moment, we'd known Rosie as a grieving mother who'd lost her beautiful young son, Luke, tragically and brutally. But at that moment when Rosie spoke to accept the Australian of the Year award, I believe she became the voice of our national conscience. Australia had for so long avoided having a nationwide public discussion about family violence, and Rosie Batty single-handedly has changed all of that. Rosie, welcome to Broad Talk, our Changemaker series. It's so lovely to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Virginia. It's so nice to know that you were down in that audience watching a very special moment and a very overwhelming moment.
It was.
And it was so daunting. I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, me? How can I be here?
I guess I felt nervous for you. That's just what I tend to do, but you handled it. And I'm sure you've been told this 1 million times, if not more. You handled it beautifully. But I just want to refer to something that you said in your book when you wrote about that moment. And I've got, look, I'm just going to paint the scene for those listening. It was a beautiful day. I remember that.
It was a stunning day.
It was warm. It was
hot.
Yeah, it was. And unlike the following year where it poured rain, it was a disaster.
And it got rained off and there was an electric storm. And
the Prime Minister of the day,
Malcolm Turnbull, we were looking as the lightning, forked lightning was happening in the background. He was stood there with an umbrella and we were thinking, this could end very badly. Having a current Prime Minister go up in smoke on live
Absolutely.
TV could have been.
It was a shocker. It was a shocker. And I was watching, I was at the front, I was actually in the sort of VIP media section at the front, and I was watching the band try to cover up cables and all that kind of stuff. It was a disaster. Anyway, that was 2016. But back on 2015, watching you, it was a really beautiful, and it was just such a lovely day and lovely moment, lovely evening. But what you said in your book was really interesting. And I'm just going to quote directly because you put it so, so beautifully and in the present tense. You said, "A sea of faces look expectantly up at me. I feel a wave of goodwill from the crowd, as if each one of them is silently reaching forward, holding me up." Now, that was such a beautiful description of a public embrace. What did it mean for you at the time? What did it do to you?
It is such a special moment, and yes, there's so many things. It was such a bittersweet moment as well. I tear up thinking about it because, you know, how could I have got this award when my son was murdered? And it was, how do I be joyful and yet intensely sad? And it was the start of such conflict. You know, here I was being given this immense honour, and, you know, there are so few Australians of the year. You know, you are part of history on so many levels, and it's incredible how people look with huge regard at that opportunity. And there's so many people had expectations sitting on me because, as you said, family violence hadn't been a topic. There was a conversation that we were ready to have, and so many people knew this could make that change. And there was so much on my shoulders to be that voice of change. And I didn't want to fail. I didn't want to let people down. And I wanted to be good enough, and I wanted to be able to create change and make difference. And that was such a pivotal moment in my life. And everything, you know, aligned to be a very special evening. The weather was perfect. I had some special friends in the audience that had traveled up from Melbourne with me. They had no idea I was going to win, and that their surprise and genuine, and my family had come from the UK and again had no idea. And so their astonishment and pride was wonderful. And we had Paul Kelly. We danced, you know, once the photos were done, and it was like paparazzi, you know, it was like, oh my gosh. I was utterly exhausted, but I danced until the night ended with us all being transported back to the hotel, and then I had to be up at about 4:30 in the morning to do all the press and all the media. And what a crazy journey it became. And it took pretty much nearly 3 years to slow down.
The pace of that, people don't realise. And look, I you know, a bit of a disclaimer here. I was in 2019, and I noticed you did a beautiful interview with Harry, in your series on One Plus One on the ABC with Harry Harris, the one of the two men who won in 2019 the Cave Divers. I was actually a nominee then, so I was sitting with them. And when you interviewed him, I was the ACT's Australian of the Year, and when you interviewed him and he said, you know, he didn't expect to win, and you said, you know, and it's true, every nominee doesn't expect it's going to be them. Can I just say, I knew it. I didn't write a speech. I absolutely knew it. I was so excited just to be there. But coming back to the day and the moment itself, and whilst joyful, as you've touched on, you know, it's bittersweet, you also say in your book that at that time you're aware that, and again, you put it in the first person, the present tense, I am the person no one wants to be, the mother who has suffered the insufferable. Mm. When you felt the crowd pulling you up by that, was it pity that you felt, and what do you do with that?
You're absolutely right, and I think the question about pity is such a significant question, because you need compassion, you need support, you need forgiveness, you need, you know, there's so many things that you need, but pity is something you don't need, and it repels you.
Mm.
And yet, what is the difference between pity and sympathy or compassion? And I think that that journey that I got, you know, from those early days of Luke being murdered, and people's avoidance of me because they didn't know what to say, or they didn't want to upset me, felt so sorry for me.
Mm.
It's kind of a burden where you think, well, how will I ever move forward? How do I survive this? How do I have a life? What do I do with this?
Mm.
And you have no idea. And you just, you know, every day you get up and it's another day you've got up. And when you go to bed that night, it's another day you're going to bed and you're crying, or there's a whole stack of stuff that's happened during the course of that day. But the day starts, the day ends, and you're still there. So, you know, it's very true. And now I enjoy people who recognize me and are delighted to meet me, and they approach me with a genuine interest in talking to me without fear, without pity. And I feel that, so I'm no longer that pitied woman. You know, I suppose they still describe me, if they haven't heard of that Rosie Batty, you know, she's the one whose son was murdered. Ah, yes, that woman.
Mm.
So I press forward. I press forward, and I don't look for pity. I don't see pity. I just continue to make my way through.
You've really transformed, I think, that pity into a real sense of purpose. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, and I understand what you mean. I mean, what do you do with all of that pity and people looking at you a certain way, and you know what they're thinking, that poor, poor woman, but you sort of shifted it to being your purpose instantly.
I think that in those very early stages when we were preparing for, you know, with some amazing people that were supporting me in my legal team for Luke's coronial inquiry, one of those, you know, would preface everything by saying, are you sure you're okay? Mm. And I said, Chris, will you stop asking me? Because every time you ask me, it reminds me I shouldn't be okay.
Yes.
I said,
yes.
Can we just get on with it? And I said, I'll tell you if I'm not okay. Mm. I'm perfectly capable of saying, I don't want to do this, or I'm not okay and I'm not going to do that, or whatever. I have a voice and I will tell you. But can we just get on with life and get on with what we need to do and work through this? Mm. And, you know, people didn't know how to be. But I think you're right, you know, in that there are many people through tragedy have done some amazing things, and they found the strength, and it's given them the purpose that they needed to find to move on in their own individual way. And, you know, and there are examples of those people, whether it's the Morecambes or the Kellys and others that have transformed their tragedy. And it's not an easy journey, but it's an example of, we don't always fall in a heap in the way that people expect, even though our journey is fraught with pain, sadness, and often, you know, self-soothing in ways that are not always healthy. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, that strength that we find within us pulls us onwards.
I guess this is the thing that fascinates at this stage so much, that strength you mention. You know, we all want to know, where do you get it from? How do you do it? I'm being a little bit facetious here because I know there is no simple answer to that. But can I just go back again to that time? And I don't want to harp on this, but
I'd like to answer that question because it's one that comes up quite a lot. And so because I'm asked that question, it's made me very reflective. And I think, you know, what I can say is I had stoicism modeled to me by my parents and grandparents. And some of that, they weren't, you know, particularly emotionally supportive when I was a young child, but I lost my mother when I was six. And so I've had, you know, through virtue of traumatic circumstances where my mother died suddenly, not through an accident and not through an illness. It was something that, you know, and it certainly wasn't family violence, but certainly what it's made me do is really understand that they have played a significant part in my journey and recovery, in knowing perhaps, you know, that influence of being modeled and being surrounded by and influenced by in those earlier years. And I think that, you know, and I have a grandmother that lived till she was 100, and she was a great inspiration to me and stepped in as a really key female figure when my mother died. So I think that, you know, those factors combine. And of course, you've got your own individual personality or whatever makes you that unique individual and human that you are.
When I first approached you about our Changemakers exhibition and I asked you to answer some questions, and you did mention when I asked you about inspiration, and you mentioned stoicism from your family, and it got me thinking a lot about what stoicism means, because I interpret stoicism as actually, and perhaps incorrectly, as closing down somewhat or being a little bit cold. What you did was quite the opposite. And I do just want to go back to the first time I ever saw you, and most Australians, was the day after Luke's tragic death, after being killed by his father, and you went outside of your house and you spoke to the waiting media. Now, as a journalist, I've had the horrible experience of being in those situations before, the death knocks, as we call them, and I had never, ever, ever in all my years seen anyone respond the way you did. You spoke really clearly, eloquently. You looked shocking. But you had what I think what struck me is you had a very clear message, and it clearly wasn't rehearsed, and it was off the top of your head. I mean, it didn't sound like, you know, you'd rehearse this in any way, shape, or form, but you were really clear about saying, I want you all to know this can happen to anyone. Can you just shed a little bit of light on that moment again?
Yeah. Look, I agree. I didn't have an agenda. I hadn't rehearsed a speech. I didn't clearly know what I was doing and had no intention necessarily of speaking to anybody. I actually had thought, if someone needs to ask the media to move away and respect my privacy, it should be me. And I didn't like the thought of people doing things on my behalf without consulting with me, even at that very tragic period of time. I had done a diploma in community welfare and I had studied family violence as an elective. So I had a theoretical understanding of family violence and the myths that surrounded it. And some of those myths are definitely that it only happens to certain types of women in certain neighborhoods. And I think I'd unpacked those myths for myself as I'd learned about, you know, the theory of family violence. And I guess, without me even knowing that was within me, that is what came out. And I do not know how or why or the moment, but some things universally align. And that was one of those moments that universally aligned. I think you're right about stoicism. It can be cold and it can be compartmentalizing. And that is how I would describe some of my family members. I think what I have been able to develop and learn through the death of my mom and the experience I had as a little girl was perhaps an overabundance of compassion and sensitivity and forgiveness. The very things that I think make up a good human being, and I'm not suggesting I'm a perfect human being, but they are the qualities that I'm proud of or seek to continue to nurture and nourish and be more of. And when I stepped out that day, I didn't want to be, I wanted to continue to be the better person that I can be and seek to be and not revert to the lesser person. And that's why I don't speak about Greg, his father, that did that. And I think that is something that, you know, I try to be respectful or not speak about things unless I can be, in a positive or in a constructive way. And so I think that you just continue to navigate the best way you can. And a lot of people really were very concerned that I'd spoken to the media because they felt that was like a slippery slope to, I don't know, some tabloid horrible experience. And I have to say that that choice bonded me in ways with the media of their utter regard and respect for me that has served and continued to serve me for the entirety of my advocacy. And I have worked with the media in the best way that I can and very well-intended and passionate journalists, male and female, who also want to play a part in how do we shift the discourse? How do we learn more about this societal issue that was, didn't even make headlines?
No,
literally, before Luke's murder.
We didn't have the language. We didn't know how to talk about it. But most importantly, we didn't have people like yourself who had experienced, you know, years and years and years of violence and family violence, who could actually speak about it eloquently, clearly, as someone who had in fact been a victim. And then suddenly there was you.
And what I will say, Virginia, and part of the greater appreciation I have had along my journey is the recognition that I'm a white, privileged, middle-class woman. I was the ideal victim. It was an unexplained tragedy. How could a son, a father murder their son in public at cricket practice? It had all the characteristics, as has the tragic and horrendous murder of Hannah Clark and her three lovely children. I have grown in my appreciation of how do I, the best way I can, highlight and get us to consider that other women have other degrees of discrimination and tragedy and trauma and pain that I will never know because of my privilege. And I feel very ill-equipped to talk about Aboriginal women, people with disability, So I have tried to learn as best I can their journeys and how how much of a struggle it is for their story to be heard and to be recognized and to be able to contribute in the very way that I've been able to.
Rosie, well, firstly, I think there's no such thing as a perfect victim, but I know exactly what you mean. And you've always said this, though. You've always been very mindful of reminding people of your so-called privilege, being a white woman who people would listen to. But you have had an incredibly powerful journey as an advocate, and I want to talk about that. But one thing I think it's worth mentioning is that everyone in Australia knows your story about the murder of Luke. But what I think people don't really know is the backstory about how much work you had done right from the outset. In fact, right after Luke's birth, when the family violence began, how you worked to try and fix things. You went through the court system. You raised the alarm over and over again. to the point where I know there was a one of the court officers had commented in 2013, the year before Luke was killed, how desperate you were in a particular court hearing, and in fact actually wrote down that Rosie seems to be a mess, as in you were trying to do everything you can. In summary, without going into detail, but in summary, the fact that you weren't, all the warnings you gave over many, many years to police, to courts, weren't in fact well heeded. Is that something that's changing, do you think, now?
Look, what I would say is you think you understand the different degrees of abuse. And I think certainly when Luke got murdered, the majority of people only considered physical abuse as real abuse, real violence. So unless it's physical, it doesn't really count. It's not really dangerous. I think one of the things we have learned over recent years is there are many different forms of violence. And in actual fact, psychological abuse and coercive control is when it is potentially the most dangerous. So I, like many others, did not recognize the degrees of different types of abuse I was experiencing as life-threatening, either to myself or Luke. We were managing the violence, and that's what victims do. They are incredibly strong, incredibly resilient, incredibly resourceful, and over many years, you manage the violence and you adjust and change things as you need to.
So are you suggesting some women don't actually acknowledge at all that they are in fact victims of violence?
Of course. You may have been in a relationship, you're not being hit. There's many of us, many that don't recognize they're in an abusive relationship. And, it's when perhaps something has escalated, or by being able to confide in family or friends, or when they do reach out and think, as we in our society gain a greater appreciation of family violence in the different forms it takes, start to realize this could be them, that when they start to reach out to those experts or reach out to people that they can trust and find out information, then it begins a journey. And ultimately what I would say is, the different forms of abuse. And then what I began to understand is I was experiencing systemic abuse, deliberate tactics, using the police, using the court systems to actually work against you. And this is exactly what happens. So ultimately, you know, there's a term, gaslighting, which is exactly where you are made to look like you are deranged. You are the problem. Now, this is incredibly exactly what the tactics were being used against myself. So as my trauma increased, as I became more distressed, more unhinged, if you like, this is exactly the deliberate tactics. And it's incredibly dangerous because our court systems and our police can see us as the problem and that therein can create problems. And ultimately, the police aren't able to do something that could, intervene with something that could happen back then. And so it's looking at, and so I think for myself, I'd never blamed the police actually, and I still don't. I think they could have made different decisions, as could I. It's easy to look back at all the red flags, which is exactly what did come up in Luke's coronial inquiry, and say, this was an opportunity, this was a red flag. But even my forensic psychologist did not see the risk to Luke.
It's extraordinary, though, reading through your biography, A Mother's Story, I was shocked at the number of red flags there were over years and years and years and years, and, how they really weren't, they weren't taken seriously.
Well, they did what they could at that particular period of time, whether it's giving me an intervention order. And some, that was a journey of 11 years. So there can be great gaps. So ultimately, what other tools are there available to you and the system? Ultimately, you can only be safe if the perpetrator chooses no longer to be violent. And of course, our very society has really colluded and condoned violence of men towards women. So this is you know, very complex, and ultimately you cannot prevent an intended and premeditated murder with all of the good intentions of a system that is supposed to be. But what we can do is work to improve and support rather than blame and minimize risk and not believe. And so ultimately there is so much work still to do. I will say, due to our Royal Commission here in Victoria, our court systems have greatly improved.
In Victoria in particular, and your advocacy in actually getting the Royal Commission to happen in the first place, which was held back in was it 2015 that the Royal Commission was held?
Look, I forget whether it's 2015 or 16. Yeah.
I think it was 15 and it reported in 2016. Mm. That's what it was. But and it was quite frankly, it was fundamentally as a result of you and your advocacy that that even happened. But I noticed that in that you mentioned or spoke about that gender inequities exist in our society that are the key drivers of violence against women. How did those gender inequities play out for you? How did you experience those sort of inequities in your life?
Look, I think we're all conditioned from the day we're born as in our gender stereotypes, and I think we're beginning to, you know, we're certainly continue to progress forward in understanding and being more aware of those. And certainly, I think, again, we're a really important part of our, you know, where we're at societally as well, where, you know, the work of Grace Tame and others have been able to really shake us up again into that, you know, realization that we still have a long way to go to actually recognize women as equals in this world. Look, it played out for me in many ways. Ultimately, I was that single mother struggling on Centrelink benefits for a period of time and really, trying to make sure that I didn't lose my home. Mm-hmm. And what I will say is that, you know, I grew up as a little girl on a farm. It was inevitable that I was the girl and supposed to marry another farmer or, you know, find my own way, whereas my brothers would inherit the farm. And so that gender difference I've always known. And that wasn't an intended way of being, but that's exactly what happened to my aunties and my father. And so I look back at that starting point in my life and I can see how conditioned I've been and how I haven't always recognized or seen or even known what to do. Mm. And I'm 60 now and I can look back at my career and see how I would have not been paid the same amount as male colleagues and had a difference in the way that I was treated or expectations placed on me. I can see that now as I look back and certainly more aware of it. I just don't think we have always understood the link between gender inequality and violence that we experience as women. And I think those links are becoming more understood and more visible and more, you know, and more part of our societal, we're starting to recognize that as ordinary everyday people rather than those amazing feminists. And I think you mentioned it, Anne Sanners, you know, people that have been working for their entirety of their careers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how disconcerting to find that we're still really pioneering and struggling.
But then again, and I come back to the power of what you have done, it has been transformative for the nation. Yes, Anne Summers has been working away and Natasha Stott Despoja, both people we've had on this series.
Lots of others as well.
And many, many, many others. Yeah. But certainly in the sort of the theoretical space, but to have someone such as Rosie Batty come forward and talk and continue to talk and to continue to advocate has really made the difference. Can I ask you too, and I mean that genuinely, I really think you have changed the national conversation.
What I've really been able to appreciate is I've worked with all of those passionate, committed, unrelenting organisations that every day seek to keep women safe. through their advocacy, through their refuges, through their, you know, continued campaigning. So many organizations that work every single day, never with enough funding, have really struggled to get genuine political leadership. Mm. It's been an onward journey. I have taken great pride in being able to partner with and amplify as best I can and seeing the part that I can play in my advocacy.
Mm.
And it is that connection of a story that was so horrific. It captured people's attentions. But I didn't have that incredibly important theoretical knowledge base, the historic campaigning and advocacy that those organizations have worked with, making governments accountable, pressing for change through justice systems that are fail people so much, you know. So for me to be able to work with those people, those organizations, has really been a source of strength and inspiration to me that have been so important on my journey.
Rosie, you set up the Luke Batty Foundation in the year that he died in 2014, before you actually became Australian of the Year. What did you want to do with that? Why did you set that up?
Look, I'd probably be like a lot of people, when something happens like that and you capture people's attention, you receive wonderful letters, such kindness on a scale that really gives you hope in humanity. It really is genuine kindness and compassion. And you will get people to suggest, they will say, you should set up a foundation. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how to do it, didn't know what I was doing, but that idea had been planted. What I will say in hindsight now, as I look back, I didn't have the professional understanding and knowledge. I didn't have the capacity and time. Mm. I was so overstretched, but I had this vision, and I'm so glad I did it. But it was a very painful journey because I was just so exhausted with everything I was doing. And, you know, to correctly set up the organization, to have the right directors and chair, the legal structure, the charity status, you know, these are big things to work out. You need great advice, the right people. And I got some amazing support. But, you know, we outgrew each other in different times as the skill sets and knowledge base needed to morph and change because the trajectory of my journey was happening so rapidly.
Well, and also there was so much demand on your time from media and not just
– From everyone, actually.
Well, from everyone, yes, of course. Yeah. And your advocacy, and when it became so clear that you were, you know, such a strong and clear and good advocate, the demands were incredible. So it was a huge thing to take on. But look, just on that, and I think we need to talk about this. So the foundation was criticised by some people, including a former Labor leader. We won't mention his name.
He deserves no mention.
No, that's why I'm not mentioning
it. We all know who you mean.
Yes, I don't want to give oxygen to it. But, you know, he was revoltingly critical. But he criticised the governance. And, look, eventually you did close the foundation down. That must have been a huge disappointment, or did it feel the right thing to do?
Look, it was, but the governance was all intact right from the very beginning because ultimately, exactly, you have to. And so that legal structure, the chair, the experience on the board, all of those things, the governance was completely above reproach. When you go digging around looking for stuff that you can blow up to be you know, and this is what happens. This is the sad thing that happens. You know, you become a target for people who you challenge and the backlash is ferocious. And, you know, whether it's myself, Grace Tame, others, and you as a female journalist, we all receive it and it is ugly. And I look at the likes of Adam Goods and he was Australian of the Year just before me. And I looked at what happened to him. Every week he would go into the football stadium and be booed. I was receiving backlash because of my cut through, but I didn't have to face a stadium of people rallying against me who didn't even recognize they were being racist or didn't want to see or acknowledge that. You know, so for me, it was horrendous to think that I could be taking money that was out of the foundation, which was so not the case. Mm. But in the end, it had become a corporatized organization that I felt I had, it was a source of great unhappiness to me. And I felt that, you know, if I was to set one up now, I would have the time, the space, and the opportunity to do it very carefully.
So did you set it up a little bit too quickly? Is that the major lesson out of that?
Look, on one level I did, but on another level, it was the perfect timing. Mm. And I think that, you know, it was just unfortunate that I needed to have a period of recovery and space to be able to do that. And I think that if you could have put something on hold for a little while and come back to it, but it doesn't work like
that. It doesn't.
So I've learned a lot of really key things from this experience. And what I did learn was, as some of, you know, those board members and chair and other people that are still very close to me said, Rosie, in the 3 years that it was open, it actually did achieve some great things. This isn't a source of disappointment or failure. And in fact, all of the money, which was, you know, at that time seemed enormous money to amount to me, it was over $1 million. I was able to re-give that, or it went to organizations that I'm very proud that it went to.
And it's important. And it is important too, of course, Rosie, not to lose sight of what the foundation did do. And I know, you know, when it comes to, you know, closing down something like that, it would, yes, you'd be very focused on what feels like a sense of failure.
I felt like I'd lost Luke again.
No.
I felt like I lost Luke again. And the grief I went through, it wasn't my decision in the end to close the organization, unfortunately. So I was very disempowered as well. So it was very conflicting, a very difficult time. But I think what it did allow me to do was grieve more deeply and at a deeper level and a more healthy level, maybe, the loss of Luke, because all those years of advocacy, I had helped me avoid more pain in some ways, and because I wasn't ready to go there. And so I think, you know, when you look at people and judge them because of their stoicism or their strength, you don't always realize what's happening in their own wall, you know, behind their own four walls, in their own private moments, or with people they trust. Mm. And for me, I was still going through a journey of PTSD, trauma, grief, and all of these things. And so, of course, my mental health wasn't great, but I was putting on that brave face. So when people kind of, you know, some of the horrible criticisms was, well, she didn't love her son enough. How can she be standing upright? How could she be doing that? You know, I've seen quite a few of those horrible comments. People just can't trust that people have, you know, we handle things in different ways. And I can't say that my way is right. It was just what I was driven to do at the time.
So in a sense, closing the foundation, in fact, difficult and traumatic as that was, it also, I guess, forced you to take a step back and give you the space that you needed. And, you know, something like PTSD is, and it's different for everyone, but it needs space, doesn't it?
Well, it takes time to come out from a traumatic event, and then you are perhaps managing it and dealing with it and living with it for, I don't know whether it's forever, but certainly it's a long, difficult journey. And I think that, you know, I look back now and see that sometimes things don't go the way we plan or we expect, but it doesn't mean that it's a failure. And now I look back and I'm quite relieved. I see that I could have done things differently with the knowledge and skills I now have. And I would be forever grateful and appreciative of the people that really came into the organization and were part of that and what we learned together. And, you know, I'm proud of that. But, you know, yes, I would approach things differently now because I'm at a different place in my life and I've learned a lot of things and developed a lot of, continue to develop skills. But I would, you know, to have done it and then realize it is a difficult journey. And there's many not-for-profit organizations and foundations that get set up that will struggle to have a sustainable sustainability, but we set it up with a passion. And to continue to keep it going, we may be the only ones because of our own personal experience that has that passion. It's a very difficult road to tread.
It is. And look, you're not the only one who has been in that position. I can think of a few others and even colleagues of mine who've experienced that sort of thing too, in the passion in the moment, taken the opportunity to set something up and then been shocked at or disappointed that it hasn't kind of rolled on or eventuated as much as they had hoped.
And I've taken great comfort in speaking to some of those people who've had those experiences, and we can share in ways that help in how, you know, it does make a difference when you can actually share with people who've been there and struggled in the similar ways. And you think, wow, so it's not necessarily just me. This is actually a very difficult road to navigate.
It is, and it's not necessarily just you at all. And in fact, sometimes these things can take various iterations before they find their own feet. They find their own space in the wider sphere. We're going to have to take a quick break, and then I want to come back and talk a little bit more specifically about what it's like being a change maker. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back. Rosie Batty, what an extraordinary story and what an incredible, incredible journey you've been on. I think that was your dog just saying hello.
Yes, I was waiting.
Well, he has been very, very, very good throughout. I just want to quote something that the fabulous Australian writer and one of my absolute heroes, Helen Garner, wrote about you. She wrote a beautiful, beautiful piece about you in the Monthly. But there's this great line where she talks about how you've got this fantastic bullshit detector, and then she says that you apply that equally to your own public persona. And then she quotes you saying, I have to be careful, and Rosie says this with her wry grin, that my little halo doesn't slip down and strangle me.
Yeah.
I love that. Oh, that made me really laugh. And she does comment about your sense of humour. That little halo, I don't really believe that you've got a halo at all. But, yeah, do you find you have to pull yourself up because you have been so much in the public eye and people tell you all sorts of things, and every time you step out they'll be telling you how much they love you. Do you have to pull yourself back every now and then?
No. Look, when that interview with Helen was really within the first few months, it was really quite – close to losing Luke. And so everything I was doing, you know, everybody thought that I was this exceptional person, and I was like, oh my gosh, if they only but knew. Not that I'm particularly bad, it's just that I am a normal person and had suddenly been catapulted into this very weird stratosphere of celebrity. Kind of, is it celebrity? Is it, what is this? And so I do bring it back to reality when people, you know, meet me and say, oh, I'm having a fangirl moment. And I say, oh, for goodness sake, you know, I am just an
Do you hate that though? Do you
I
find
am.
That a bit awkward?
No, I try to move through it very quickly because ultimately it's a real honor for people to have. And often these people, who, no matter how professional and who they are, it's because they have a backstory. And inevitably, I will have been a source of inspiration or hope or a vision of possibility. And so when they say things like that to me, how amazing. But what brings you back to down to earth is either your family or the people who've known you forever, or just walking my dogs down at the dog beach when, you know, your dog does something that annoys somebody else, like, hey, get your dog under control, you know, or something like that. And you realize, you know, there is no tickets on me. I'm just an – and I – look, my dad is a very ordinary down-to-earth person, and I've been brought up that way. And I always want to be that approachable, inclusive, thoughtful person, and I hope if I'm ever not, people pull me
up. You know, it's obviously very important and to have people around you that do keep you grounded, and this is something that's been a bit of a theme in Changemakers. I really had a chuckle at the story about, and it sort of felt inappropriate even laughing about it, but one of your friends contacted you after you did that first press conference, that media conference outside your house, and everyone was saying, oh, you know, poor Rosie, and Rosie, don't talk to the media and don't do this and don't do that. And one of them contacted you and said, woman, you look shit. Fix yourself up.
Tidy yourself up, woman. You look like
shit.
Yeah,
I loved it.
And do you know what? When we talked earlier about pity, people were, you know, heartbroken for me. They were deeply touched themselves, of course, because they knew Luke, their kids were in the same class as him, they, you know, all of this. But Ben wasn't frightened of my grief. And he would ring me every day, and he rang me for 4 years.
Wow.
Now, he has his own story from childhood, and, you know, I don't disclose what those stories are, but, you know, so he wasn't frightened of grief. He just plowed straight in. And I needed that. Gosh, I needed that. People were horrified. My close friends were thinking, well, how can he speak to her like this? And I would be laughing. I'd be laughing at how inappropriate he would be, how deliberately provocative he would be. And it continued. And he would say to me, oh, I can't even read my newspaper without your head being on the front of it. You know, so he constantly had, you know, digs at me, and it all made me laugh. And I think what I remember, you know, I'll always appreciate from him, and he's still a dear friend, is he wasn't afraid of my grief. He wasn't afraid of upsetting me. He just went in as a normal person having a normal conversation with
me. That's such a good lesson, isn't it? Not to be afraid of someone's grief in order to help them.
And look, to be honest, I don't know how I would have been with somebody in my situation. I've learned a lot from being in this situation and being that person. But people genuinely, you know, don't know what to say. And I would say to them, it's okay to say, I don't know what to say. This is shit. And give people permission to just be embarrassed or uncertain, and you know, you end up kind of helping people to be in that moment, with you, I guess.
It's unfortunately we're going to have to wind up because we've gone way over time, and it's been so lovely talking to you. I could talk to you for hours, for the whole day, but I just want to bring you back to, I mentioned earlier that you have been hosting a series on the ABC, the 1+1 interview series, and your series is looking at accidental leaders, of which you are probably the most famous accidental leader. Unlike you, most hadn't necessarily experienced extreme, the trauma, but some pretty shocking circumstances nevertheless. Thinking of people like Walter Mikak, who lost his two daughters in Tasmania.
And look, with Harry Harris.
And Harry was, thinking of too. But what did you learn from that series? Was there a sort of a single thing that really resonated with you about all of you as accidental leaders thrust into the public eye?
I think that what I did learn was each of those people embraced the opportunity to meet with me in that series to have this conversation. They came to the conversation with me in a way that perhaps they felt more comfortable to do so than they would if I had been a trained journalist, because there was that understanding of knowing who I was and the journey I had been through. They didn't know me personally. They just knew of me through my advocacy and experiences. And that was so comfortable for me to really appreciate that and to understand that people who have been through life-changing experiences and just done the best they can with what they've been given to make some kind of change or difference, there is an understanding that isn't necessarily expressed in words, that we can trust. We can trust each other. There's no agenda here other than to learn from each other in ways that may other people may get inspiration and in some way support, you know, help people in their own journey through life. And I think we do, you know, by having meaningful conversations, we gain insight into our own lives. We gain comfort, the fact that we aren't unique always, and that actually people can experience horrific things and survive and go on to get through life and find moments of happiness and joy that seem impossible. And maybe, you know, that's what I have got from other people, the fact that I can get through this, I can find a way of living that is not going to be full of pain at every moment of every day. And when you are in those bleak periods, and for me, the bleakest period was probably 3 years later, and it was around the time of losing my foundation, as it was all kind of coming to that, I didn't want my life to continue. It was so painful, and I couldn't see that it would ever end and the pain would always be there. I just wanted something to take me out. And I almost willed a terminal illness or an accident. And so I look at that and say, people thought the worst of my journey was going to be at the time of Luke's murder, the time it happened, and those immediate weeks and months. And some people don't understand that when you have an angry outburst or an extreme emotional reaction to something that hurt, that they can't understand or they feel hurt by, that it comes out for years. And you're dealing with pain and anger and a whole stack of emotions that you didn't realize were still going to come out months and years later. So the journey for all of us isn't wrapped up neatly within the first few weeks and the first few months and maybe in the first year of loss. You know, it's a painful, difficult journey for most of us, I would say, for a longer time than that. And I don't think we always fully appreciate that the support we're ready to give with all the goodwill stuff, you know, the cooking of meals and the, you know, the flowers and the kindness that we experience in those first few weeks and months, genuine displays of care. We need it we need it down the track. We need to continue to be included in invitations to things and for people to continue to keep that connection going. But we realize that life has changed and you grieve the life that you lost, and you have to embark on a new journey. And some of those relationships and friendships separate, but new relationships develop. And I think that's where I'm at now, is those are established friendships that have a security for me that have more than replaced other, you know, seeming friendships that perhaps didn't go the distance.
Is that what has pulled you through those periods of feeling like you didn't want life to go on?
Oh, for sure. I think that at the time when I was grieving the loss of the foundation, I felt an abject failure, a fraud. Every bit of self-loathing and everything I'd battled to keep perspective on and kept at bay just consumed me. And I retreated and kept fairly isolated. And it was those people who still, no matter seeing me my most vulnerable or what I would have said is my worst display of myself, they saw beyond that and saw the real me and never lost the real me. And being able to know that those people, and they'd been there through the entirety of the journey, they mattered. They mattered more than anyone else. And so now those genuine friendships have weathered those storms. And some of them have been key men in my life that, you know, my father, my brothers, but also Bryce, who wrote my book, Justin, who is my agent, Ben, who is that guy that told me to tidy myself up. They've been amazing men who have been incredibly supportive. Peter Starr, that was my media advisor, incredible supports and continue to be those genuine friendships. They have helped me regain who I am and like myself and recognize I am flawed. I am flawed like every other human being, trying to be the best I can in this world, trying to do work that makes some kind of difference. And to just accept myself as less than perfect is an ongoing battle for myself as I strive to be that perfect person and fall short. And I am not alone in that either. And so I talk openly about these things because I hope that it gives other people insights into themselves. They say, you know what? She's right. I'm that person too. And it gives us permission to be perhaps that little bit more vulnerable and know that we can get through this or we can navigate our way through very challenging and disappointing and sad times.
Rosie, on top of everything else, you're incredibly wise. Thank you. Thank you. I wish we could go on talking forever, but we're going to have to close there. But it has been such an honour to sit here and talk with you and to just hear you share so honestly. And I know it's an incredibly powerful thing for anyone that hears you speak this way. So thank you. And thank you for your generosity of your time and your gift of sharing. We are better for it. So thank you. There's so much
thank
in that.
You,
there's just so much that I will take away and I'm sure all our listeners will too to mull over. So many pearls of wisdom. And I want to thank all of you, those of you who have stayed with us for this wonderful conversation with Rosie and also throughout this series, the Broad Talk Changemakers series. Martin and I are going to take a break and hopefully come back with some more changemakers later this year or early next year. But it's been a fantastic journey and we've thoroughly enjoyed it and really, really appreciate your input, your feedback and your reviews and rating of Broad Talk. So make sure you do download and follow Broad Talk wherever you're listening to us on whatever platform. And that way, the next time we have an episode, it will drop automatically into your little box. And I really look forward to spending some more time with you again a little bit down the track. And don't forget, you can keep up to date with what we're doing at Broad Talk on my Facebook page or our Broad Talk Facebook page. On Twitter, you'll find me at Virginia_House. And of course, we're at Insta on Broad Talkers. We also have a little website, broadtalk.net, where there will be bits and pieces and the occasional blog as well. You can find all our episodes for all four series of Broad Talk, including Australian Women Changemakers, but also Leadership. And we did a huge series in the first year of Broad Talk with some fascinating interviews and some fascinating people. And we're certainly planning to come back with many, many more. So do stick with us. But in the meantime, thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us. And don't forget, keep talking.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.